Welcome again. As you know, this service, if you've been looking at your order of service, is titled Surfing. Full disclosure, I do not surf. I have had one surfing lesson. Jennifer and I had one surfing lesson. It was really fun. It was great. I was never in water that was above like my waist, so it was very manageable. You could kind of push off from the ground and jump on, but that was it. In general, I don't like cold water. And so I tend to avoid activities, and I've never been in a place where the water was warm enough to feel like it was really warm enough to surf. So I'm not excluding the possibility, but just so far, it's not been my favorite thing. But I spent a lot of time in California, where my father used to live, and just down the street from his house, you can see people surfing every morning. And so I've spent a lot of time out there. You can see them from the upstairs of his house. When you take a walk along the coast, you can see them. And so I've observed them. I've meditated upon what they're doing out there. And they have many, many admirable qualities that they show, these surfers. First, dedication. I mean, it can be 45 degrees out and miserable and foggy at 7 in the morning on a Wednesday, and they're out there. Very, very dedicated. They have patience. They just sit. You know, they're like waiting for the wave, becoming one with the universe or something, I don't know, but they're very patient. They have skill. They surf really, really too close to the rocks, in my opinion, but they manage to do it without hurting themselves. They also have trust that I'm not sure I would have. Just down from where my father's house is, if you go down a ways, there's a place where a lot of surfers congregate. And when the waves are big, they're zipping right next to each other in ways that look like they just could be hospital cases in any moment. And yet they somehow just kind of managed to make it work. I'm very impressed. But I'm not going to today meditate on any of those particular qualities about the surfers. That's kind of their deal. What I want to do is to go back to that Jack Kornfield quote at the very beginning and think a little bit about the relationship between the surfers and the waves, or obviously between us and life. The metaphor is not too hard to pick apart in this one. But I think it has some use there. You know, I mean, waves are kind of there. Nothing you can do about them. You know, you can like them, you can not like them, you can't conjure them up, except if you're in a water park and that's a different kind of scene. You know, you can't make them happen, you also can't stop them from happening. They are going to be there. They can be beautiful and amazing, they can be dangerous, they can be deadly, they can be life-threatening. And there's really kind of no way to control that. So that's kind of a good representation of life. Now the question is, you know, how do we relate to these kind of unpredictable and unknowable ups and downs? And the Kornfield quote, I think, is very good about, well, you learn to balance, and we can kind of intuitively imagine what that means, but I kind of want to think about what it means in kind of real life, the actual day-to-day living. How do we bring that sort of lesson into real life? And the first one that comes to me, because it's one of the most pernicious life issues, is just pain. I hope none of you ever feel pain ever again. But it's just not realistic. It's all going to happen to us, right? It's just, you know, it's just inevitable. I don't know if you've heard the expression, what doesn't kill you gives you low back pain. Well, that's been my experience. I've had low back pain. I know some of you have had it out there. Man, it is, if you've had it, you know, it just takes over your consciousness. I mean, it's like, and other pains, kinds of pain do this too. For me, sore throats do this. If I have a sore throat, nothing in the world is right. I just, you know, it colors my view of everything. And so when you're in pain, whether it's low back pain or something else, something chronic, something acute, what do? You can try to eliminate it. Drugs, therapy, hypnosis, whatever. If that works, cool. But it doesn't always work. Sometimes, like with low back pain, I have never found anything that will help with low back pain except waiting it out. And waiting it out means a long time. It can be a week, can be 2 weeks, can be a month, depends. So if you have pain and you can't get rid of it, well, that's when we sort of say, okay, well, what can we do? And I think there are some things we can do to reduce our suffering. For me, The way this works is to think about the stories that I tell while I'm having pain. This is where I add a lot of suffering to my own life. So when I have pain, I often have thoughts like, I shouldn't be feeling this way. Or, if I hadn't done X, what an idiot. If I hadn't picked up the thing, or tried to tie my shoes, or done too much yoga, or not done enough yoga, or whatever it is, I wouldn't be having this. Or, this pain will never go away. I will never ski again. I will never, you know, rock climb. I don't rock climb, but I will never do these things again. You know, I'll never run. I'll never walk. You know, or, and this is a really good one, this is the beginning of the inevitable decline into decrepitude that I am experiencing. I will never be healthy again. I mean, that is how you add suffering to pain, insult to injury. So I was reading When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron. You may know this book. She's a meditation teacher. And in the introduction, she has this place where she's reflecting. She's going through these boxes of cards that were sort of her notes for talks she's given over the years. And she said, I began to see that in some way, no matter what subject I had chosen, what country I was in, or what year it was, I had taught endlessly about the same things. The great need for loving kindness towards oneself, and developing from that the awakening of a fearlessly compassionate attitude toward our own pain and that of others. And that phrase, a fearlessly compassionate attitude towards our own pain and others, and not achieving it, but working to develop it, that's my understanding anyway of one of the kind of the core themes of Buddhism. That you're meeting reality as it is. You're not trying to cling to it, you're not trying to push it away, you're not trying to change it, but you're meeting it with some sort of compassion towards yourself and others, because things are just not, almost always not going to be just the way you want. The part about compassion is going to come back in a minute, but I think that's the first part of this sort of the balancing act that Kornfield was talking about. It's like, okay, we're going to see what happens with the waves. We're going to try to meet them in some way. And we're going to kind of have a little bit of looseness in the way that we hold ourselves with it, and the way that we hold them. We're not going to curse the waves as much, perhaps, and we're not going to curse ourselves as much. We're simply going to try to be there with them. But it doesn't mean that you just accept the way life is and don't do anything about it. I mean, we do have agency. We have some efficacy in the world. And if you watch the surfers, you can see. I mean, they're out there. They're kind of trying to zen it out, you know, and see when the wave's going to come. And then when they do come, they have to, you know, they've been inactive, and then they have to paddle really, really hard if they want to try to catch the wave. Catching the wave is tricky because you have to predict where it's going to be, and you have to paddle just hard enough. You paddle too hard, you get too ahead of it, it crashes onto you. If you don't paddle hard enough, the wave kind of goes underneath you and you miss it. So there is a kind of a timing that you have to work with. And you just kind of have to deal with how well it works out. I had an experience of this just the other night. It's a very prosaic first world experience, but it was real to me, so I feel like I can talk about it. I was trying to get back here from California the other night, Friday night, and my plane got delayed out of Los Angeles. And then in the air, we got even more delayed, and I and a lot of the people around me were all facing missing flights. And so we landed, and the flight attendants gave an announcement and said, well, here's the flights that have departed, here's the ones that haven't yet. You know, Pittsburgh, you've got 2 minutes. Okay, so I was like three concourses over, and I had 2 minutes to get to my plane. And I talked to the flight attendant, and she said, well, you know, you never know, you might as well try. I'm like, all right, you might as well try. So the door of the plane opens up, and the people in front of me who had to get to a wedding, I let them go first. And then I, you know, and I kind of felt almost, because I was writing the sermon at the time, right? I was running breakneck through the Minneapolis airport with this giant backpack on my back because I always carry too much stuff, and running to try to get to my plane to Pittsburgh, and I need to be in better shape because I couldn't run the whole way, but I tried and I kept going. And, you know, 2 minutes, there was no way. But, you know, you never know. Sometimes they hold the plane. Anyway, they did not hold the plane. And I got there and I missed the plane and all of this stuff. And Yeah, but I was thinking about it, like, whoa, okay, this is one of those moments where I could try to do this thing that Cornfield was talking about. I could try to surf this particular. I was kind of frustrated. I wasn't mad so much. I mean, the flight attendants, the pilots, they didn't have anything to do with it. Somebody screwed up somewhere, but we don't know why. Whatever. Right? But, you know, it's like, now I got to figure out what to do and where I'm going to stay and all of this stuff. And, you know, it all worked out. You know, eventually the airline realized it was their mistake and they put me in a hotel and I got to listen to a Minnesotan shuttle bus driver at 6 in the morning telling Sven and Ole jokes. And it's like, yeah, you hear Sven and Ole, they got fired from their job at the orange juice factory. Seems they couldn't concentrate. I mean, literally, 6 in the morning he was doing this. It was great. It was so fun. So anyway, you know, there is a way to kind of, you have to kind of go for stuff, and then you have to kind of recognize that sometimes you go for it, and it doesn't happen. And sometimes you catch the wave, and sometimes you don't. It's partly about, if any of you have seen Ted Lasso, it's partly about having a 3-second memory, like a goldfish. It's, you know, when something bad happens, if you keep carrying it along, it causes suffering. I mean, I rode into the airport the next morning with somebody who had been on my flight, and she was still agitating. She was still quite angry. It's a natural experience to have that anger, but it also was causing her a lot of suffering, I could see. So part of it is about not dwelling on something that's not happening. And then another part is about having compassion for yourself when you do. Yeah, you know, you don't get to go where you want to go and it's inconvenient and it's painful and all that stuff. And so sometimes you get mad, and having that, being able to have a little bit of space to give yourself in those moments is good, that compassion. So I think a lot of this is about relationship to what happens in the world, but a lot of it is about relationship to ourselves. And how do we feel about ourselves? And are we able to kind of tolerate the ups and downs and the imperfections that are in our own experience? And this probably takes the metaphor just one step too far, but I'll do it anyway because why not? I don't know if you've ever been in a wetsuit or in a bathing suit, you know, but you really can't hide very much. You know, it kind of shows everything that's there, you know, and you're kind of in your whole body with its perfections. And now, there's some of us out there who are going to look like, you know, beach gods and goddesses when they're in those outfits. Not many of us, though. Certainly not me. And so, you know, what do you do with the fact that, you know, I kind of like to look one way to the world, and yet I look like what I look like. I am who I am. How do you deal with that disjuncture between an idealized version of yourself and the version of the self that you really are? There's a sermon by Paul Tillich, the theologian Paul Tillich, that has been echoing in my brain for 20 years or 30 years now, ever since I read it, called Escape from God. And he deals exactly with this issue. And I'll just give you a little bit of the highlights of it. He starts, until it does, with Psalm 139, which you may know. It starts with, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether." And then it continues, "Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence?" And Tillich kind of does a long commentary on the whole psalm. And he suggests, you know, it's kind of oppressive to think of someone or something. And when he talks about God, it's in the broadest possible sense, the ground of being. It's not necessarily a single person or entity. But it's kind of oppressive knowing that you can't get away. It's like you're sitting down, you're lying in the psalmist, you know, if I'm in heaven, if I'm in hell, anywhere, I'm known, I'm seen. No wonder the psalmist wants to flee from this. It's like, you know, I can't get away. But then Tillich says, you know, actually, that even though it's a natural impulse to want to flee from that, it's the idea that you can flee from being known is kind of a fiction. And he says, these are Tillich's words, "We all know that we cannot separate ourselves at any time from the world to which we belong. And there's no ultimate privacy or final isolation. We're always held and comprehended by something that's greater than we are, that has claim upon us and that demands response from us. The most intimate motions within the depths of our souls are not completely our own, for they belong also to our friends, to humankind, to the universe, and to the ground of all being, the aim of our life. Does anybody really believe that their most secret thoughts and desires are not manifest in the whole of being, or that the events within the darkness of their subconscious or in the isolation of their consciousness do not produce eternal repercussions? And I kind of love this because, you know, Tillich says there's kind of a, it feels impressive at first to know that you're not, you can't really hide yourself. But there's a way in which it's completely liberating too. Because when you acknowledge, oh yeah, actually, that I'm here and I'm kind of intimately connected with you all, whether I want to be or not, no matter how I present myself to you, there is another truth that also somehow comes through. Well, life just gets a lot easier. You know, you don't have to spend so much energy trying to put up this front, trying to convince people, trying to manipulate them into accepting a version of myself that I want everyone to accept. You don't have to be so careful all the time. But most importantly, for me anyway, it means you can have real relationships. Real relationships with yourself and with other people, because you're acknowledging the deep, intimate, inevitable connectedness of all beings. So having that sense is actually really, it's really liberating. And yet, of course, it's still our natural experience and our habits, for many of us, to try to stay separate too, and to try to make sure people understand us only in the way we want. I was having a conversation the other day with a friend of mine in New Zealand who she writes a lot. She's been writing journals for years and years and years. And all the stuff, all of her thoughts, reflections, everything. She's got them on this big bookshelf, and she's got this big sign that tells her two daughters, when I die, destroy all these. You know, and I just had this experience with my father. My father died a couple of years ago, and he and I had a good relationship, and I loved him very much. But he had these journals. When I was going through his stuff after he died, he had these typewritten journals, and he had a thing on the front that said, destroy these upon my death or I will come back to haunt you. You know, and I did. I consulted with my sister, and we decided it was important to honor his wishes, so. And there's bad karma to go against them, really. But, you know, I'm pissed off about it because I had an opportunity to know my father in a way, in an uncensored, unfiltered way that I wouldn't have gotten, that I couldn't have gotten any other way, because these were things he was writing to himself. And he didn't want me to read them. Okay, I didn't read them. But I feel like I've missed an opportunity there. I didn't tell my friend that she should let her daughters read her journals, and I'm not telling you you should do the same thing. I will tell you that in my estate planning document, I tell my children where all of the computer files are that are on my computer, and I have a little content, you know, like trigger warning for the few files that they should be careful about before they read, you know? Fair enough. Then they can make that decision what they want to read and what not. So, I mean, all this doesn't mean I'm going to show up here in church in a wetsuit or something. Given the weather, it's probably okay, but, you know, or in a bathing suit, you know. It's just that I think the metaphor of surfing helps me to understand it's not just about having that compassionate, dynamic, alive relationship with what happens, but also with myself. I'm going to try to show up here as much as I can, with you, with my kids, with life, as much as possible. And it doesn't mean I need to impose myself on anybody. But it means kind of showing up in as full an expression of the complication and the reality that I'm living as possible. And then to also open up to that compassion that I think does come from me, but also comes, as Pema Chodron was talking about, you know, from something much bigger, from something that we are all a part of. We can't generate that kind of level of compassion on our own, but we can tap into it as a part of the ground of being that surrounds us. So nurturing the awareness of that compassion, breathing it in, feeling it, that to me, that's the spiritual practice. That's what we're about. So one way or another, you know, every day we get on those surfboards, we head out into the waves. And let's see what kind of adventurous rides we can get into today. Amen.